Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Luke Lalonde of veteran Canadian band Born Ruffians. The group's latest album, Beauty's Pride, is out June 6th via Yep Rock Records in the United States. In this conversation, we discuss how a lineup change led to new musical choices, how becoming a parent changed Lalonde's perspective on life and more, as well as his relationship with the group's audience. That's Luke Lalonde of Born Ruffians on Into Music, coming up now. Yeah, tell me a little bit about the starting point for this record. Is this kind of one of those things where, you know, it's time, you know, now it's this point in the contract or whatever, we know we've got another album due, we better start writing? Or is this something where it's like you're always writing and now it's just time to bring together the tunes?
More the second one, because we're always writing. I come here every day that I can and I write, and I'm not always sure what I'm writing for, but just for the act of writing. But actually, I mean, that does come and go. Usually after we do something, there's a bit of a period of not writing where just enter a different mode. With this record, and because we have our own label now in Canada, we still are on an American label called Yep Rock, but in Canada we have our own label. We've been fairly, I guess, like our owning our own business type feeling. Like we're kind of our own bosses. So there hasn't been that feeling of we're contractually, like we got to make a record. For quite a while, but we've always sort of just been looking towards the next record basically as soon as we're finished the previous one. But this one started, it was the pandemic hit, obviously, and we put out we had a bunch of music ready to go. We were going to put it out regardless, but when the pandemic hit, we decided to just do it and not delay the releases. And we toured that record the year following in 2021. And then we started to write again without really an idea of what we were writing for, and recorded a couple songs in Toronto, and we put them out as standalone singles. And that was sort of the beginning of the writing. Those songs didn't end up on the record, but that was sort of the beginning of the writing. We put out these two songs, Don't Fight the Feeling and Chrysanthemums. And then just kept going. And I think writing with Maddie, who joined our band, I think we had our first practice with Maddie the day before the NBA canceled its season and the day before all that stuff happened. So Maddie joined the band like the day before the pandemic, before it all hit the fan. And once we kind of got back up and running and started to work on material, it became clear pretty fast that we should be writing with Maddie, because she just slid into that process so comfortably, providing parts and starting songs. The way we jam sometimes is just like something will take us apart or whatever, and we'll just a keyboard part or a bass line or whatever, we'll just start playing with it and jamming, and then it'll become a song. And several songs are starting with Maddie just making something up on the keyboards, and then her vocals are amazing and they blend with my voice in a really beautiful way. So we just were like, let's write this record with Maddie. And so I guess it started in 2022, but then we started recording in the summer of 2023. And now it's 2 years later and the record's coming out finally. So excited.
Yeah. So, I mean, the core of the band, there have been a couple of lineup changes, but the core of the band has really been together from the start. So now you have a new member. Presumably, you know, you did the usual kind of vetting and everything, but you don't really know what the chemistry is going to be, right? So was it always on the table that she was going to write, or was it just kind of that surprise of like, oh, that's cool?
Yeah, sort of. Like, the chemistry is definitely paramount for us. We know, obviously, we want somebody who can play their instrument and stuff, but it's not crucial that they be virtuoso super, you know, shredder. Maddie is also really good at playing piano and guitar. She's kind of a jack of all trades, but we knew we got along with Maddie, which was the main thing. Can we hang out with this person in a van for 8 hours a day? You know, that's sort of the main the main box to tick if you're talking about bringing somebody into the band. And we knew we got along with Maddie. Our sense of humor is matched, and she's just like a buddy. But it was a nice, very, very nice, pleasant surprise when we started to work on creatively, and it just felt very natural, like we had always been. Like it kind of felt like she'd always been in the band. Like when you meet a new person and you feel like you've known them for a long time, and you just kind of already feel like you're buddies and friends. It was like that musically, and so I don't. Yeah, there was really no debate or question or conversation. It was just like, yeah, Maddie's in the band now. You know.
Well, one of the things that I really love on this record is that it moves through these different moods and settings. And so it's like it starts off very with like kind of a lot of exuberance, and then there's a mood shift, and we do that about every three or four songs. Was that something that, when did that kind of come into view, that there were these elements that you could kind of play with and go, okay, we're going to move from this to this to this?
A lot of the flow of the track listing was decided after, but we did know the balance of things is definitely always on our mind, and we recorded 18, 19 songs. We cut that down for the record, but the balance is always sort of at the forefront. And before that, I mean, we cut about, so I think we cut the list in half. We started with about closer to 40 demos of fully written songs that we liked. We were like, it was 38 actually. We had 38 songs, and then put that to kind of a group vote of like the inner circle of the band and our producer Roger. And that got cut down to the 19 that we recorded, and then that got cut down to Beauty's Pride, the record. And so we didn't necessarily have the flow of the record from the outset, and that sort of was decided towards the end of when we were recorded everything, when we had recorded everything. But it's definitely at the forefront of our mind, the balance of fast and slow, bright and dark, you know, moods that you want to. I like records that have peaks and valleys and that aren't sort of just one note through the whole thing. And just the nature of what the way we write, with just kind of allowing everything through the gate, we know we're going to have, you know, relative to the band's sound, we know we're going to have a variety of styles and sounds and different types of songs, and wanting to incorporate all that while also wanting to take a step in a new direction with this record too. That was also part of an intentional, it was an intentionality. And having Maddie come in as part of that too, knowing like having a fourth person in here who hasn't written with us is going to naturally bring a new sound to the band. We wanted to also push it forward even before bringing Maddie in. We were like kind of aware that we needed to and wanted to expand our sound. But yeah, it was, I really like records with a good flow that bring you to somewhere and then kind of like give you a breather, an interlude, and then kind of pick you back up. And it's sort of like a set list to a live show. You just want to like take people on a journey for sure.
Since we're talking about Maddie, there's that moment with "Can We Go Now?" and then it moves into "Incoming," and then we get to this part of the album that's like, in my estimation, super Beatly.
Oh, nice.
it's like a Beatles EP or something at the at the end of the record. But I just thought that was such a genius bridge between one part of the music and the other.
Yeah. Knowing where to place that song was key because it's the first time anybody else has sung lead on a Born Ruffians record. I mean, like we like to take everything very seriously as if we are the Beatles in a way. You kind of have to. It's like you're playing house or something as a kid. Like we're aware that we're not the Beatles, that the world's not waiting to see the debut of like a different singer on a Born Ruffians record. But it helps to sort of think of it that way. Like, when's Maddie going to make her debut? When is that song going to come in? So Maddie, I guess for anybody listening, Maddie sings lead on a song, which is, yeah, for the Born Ruffians fans, that'll be like, oh, cool. Like, we've only ever heard Luke sing. So that was important. Like, where are we going to put that? And also, we had a number of slower songs. And there is always with a band, even in your live, especially in your live show, I should say, where do you put the slower songs in? Because there's a, especially for rock bands, it's like the eternal, you feel a little self-conscious when you play a slow song in a way, even though you know people are just listening and enjoying it, but the energy comes down. So you want to balance those out. And if you put them all at the front of your record, you're sort of telling people like, this is this kind of record. If you put them at the end, you're telling them this is this kind of record. And so we wanted this record to feel energetic, but we knew we had a lot of slower songs and a little bit more of a calm vibe. So we did kind of like push those a little to the back of the record with the intention of sort of like having that be the intentional flow of the record to bring you down into that sort of like calm ending more or less. But and the Beatles thing, it's not really intentional, but they are for sure part of like my, I can't escape them in a way. They're the ever present influence, part of my like musical DNA, I guess you would say, which is very cliche, but it's true. Like just that it's my parents' music that I grew up with. So it's my childhood too. So they're just part of my, I always say they're like language for me. I can't remember not knowing the Beatles songs. And that goes for like quite a bit of that era of music. I don't remember hearing them for the first time because they're just have always been part of my, you know, world, I guess. So yeah, it's hard to escape sometimes the power of the Beatles.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like if ever there's a moment where it's like, gosh, you know, like, oh man, I don't, let me do it if I have to, and then it'll come on the radio and I'm just like, oh yeah, of course, this is like, you know, would I kick my brother out of the family, you know?
I know. I'll go through long periods of just not listening to them, not really intentionally, and then something will come on, help, whatever, and you'll just be like, wow, genius. This is so good. Like, and just their story too, not to derail this too much, but I love the Beatles story. And I'm not a Beatles voracious reader of Beatles books, but I've read a couple and a few. And just their story. I love the Beatles story, just the arc of it. It's so built into the Beatles is this feeling of loss and tragedy too. Growing up post, you know, the death of John Lennon, that's always there. This like, it was cut short. The breakup was too soon. They could have gone on. And then Lennon died. There's this like real sadness undertone to all of their songs that kind of underpins everything just because of their story more than the music itself. Like, I don't know. Anyways, I could go on. We could do a whole show about why I like the Beatles, but nobody wants to hear that. So,
well, and there is that thing, and now I'm gonna, but there is that thing about them that I find this so often with bands that it's like there's that outsider element where you have these two guys who lost their mothers very young. You have this other guy who was sickly as a kid, and then this other guy who, the, you know, the Catholic kid who's a little strange, younger than the others. And it's like they all have that outsider element, and then they come together and make something that makes everybody feel welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. And they become the further we get from the Beatles era, the more people can forget, just like any pop culture thing, how big they were. I mean, these four people went and became bigger than I think anything we can imagine now. Taylor Swift is obviously that level of star, and that's the closest thing we have to it. But I think it was more all-consuming than just the way media worked and stuff, right? So it's just, it's hard now for people who didn't live through it or have kind of an innate understanding of that to appreciate that as well, how big they were. It's almost unimaginable, like the influence and impact they had on people's lives and stuff. It's just, and they were just, like you said, four outsider regular guys, you know, from Liverpool. It's a wild story. I love it. I love the Beatles.
to go back to Maddie singing on the record, this is indicative to me that there was no ego involved in this. This wasn't a case where it was like, okay, I sing all the songs, you're going to have to arm wrestle me for this. Was this just like really a point where it was like, okay, I've sung all the songs, I really do, I want to give somebody else a chance? And
yeah, for sure. I I don't want to say I twisted Maddie's arm, but I did ask her because I could understand her perspective coming into a band that's been around playing together for over 20 years and, releasing records for close to that. That if I'm in her shoes, I might be kind of going like, I don't know if I want to do that. Not that I'm uncomfortable, but I could see her being like, this is your thing. Like, you don't, this is, maybe you don't want. So I had to ask her a few times, like, hey, no pressure. If you have a song or two or whatever that you might want to throw into the ring, though, like, we would love to work on them, hear them. And eventually she did bring that song in, and we were like, this is great. Let's play it. Let's work on it. And so I feel like there's definitely. I mean, there's always ego, there's always pride, that kind of thing. But I think our band, and this is, I guess, maybe I'm not the guy to like make this, to adjudicate this or to make this statement because I am the like archetype of the, I'm the lead singer, whatever. The guy would have the ego. But I think we've always maintained a very democratic process. And it's just the way the chips fall too. I mean, I have always just been the songwriter. It's not like I've ever said like, you guys, we're not playing your songs. It's just the way it is. I just always bring the songs in. Mitch and Steve aren't sitting at home demoing and writing songs. It's just not what they do. They like playing the songs. They like jamming. But I was very excited at the prospect of that. So I did urge Maddie a few times to, please, if you want, bring a song in, we'll work on it. I would love to do that. Yeah, I was eager and excited to have another voice on the record and to collaborate in a bigger way, yeah, on songwriting. Yeah.
Do you think that that's in some ways kind of the behind the longevity of the band in a way, in that people understand their roles and but at the same time there's also a willingness to kind of change and go, okay, we can't stay in the same place forever. We got to move on and do something different from time to time.
I think you have your Ramones and your AC/DCs who thrive on the amazing thing they found that they created, and they do it so well, and they do it over and over, and they don't really change, and that's amazing. And then, but that's really rare. I think most bands to survive or to keep going and to keep enjoying what they do, and this probably goes for most things in life, you do have to. You need to inject newness into it. You need to innovate and find new things to keep it exciting, to keep yourself interested. And otherwise, yeah, you feel like you're making the same thing over and over and it feels stale and pointless. And yeah, I just don't know why we would do that. So it really comes down to the moment you're doing something too, or you're not really thinking about it as a record, as something going out into the world, you're just doing it on the day. You're just here in the studio, you're just making something. And the thing that drives that for us is like trying to do something new, exciting and fun, and without any thought of like, let's recreate this thing that we did that was successful. I think the other thing we have that I joke about is we're blessed with not really ever having a big hit. We've had moderate success. I won't say that we've been like toiling away, but we're not millionaires from a big hit we had that we're trying to recreate, right? We've never had that thing. So we've always been, in a way, trying to find our way. And even 20 years on ish, into our late 30s, we still maintain this feeling of like, I don't know, like we're trying to build something, or we're always resetting in a way and trying to redo or make the thing. We're never trying to, or sorry, I just said we're trying to redo. We're always trying to make the thing. We're always trying that again. We're never trying to redo anything. We're never trying to recreate a nostalgia that we think we have with fans or something. Yeah.
This kind of dovetails into something else, which is that, you mentioned you're sitting in the band's rehearsal space, you have your own label, the band has this longevity, the relationships are what they are. But back when you were 16, 17, you had no idea that that stuff was on the plate, right? And then there becomes that moment where it's like you have a little bit of success. All of a sudden, maybe you can pay your bills based on music. And you're like, it'd be really dumb if we'd let this go, right?
Yeah.
When did that happen for you guys?
Well, I mean, yeah, it happened early. I mean, looking back at that age, I wish I could kind of get back into that age or my head and be like, what were you really experiencing? Because it's like a blur in a way. And there was so much going on. And I think I was a different person then. And I was dealing with a lot of anxiety and all the things that you deal with at that age, and maybe unable to fully appreciate what was happening around us as a band and to fully like take it in. But it was early. I mean, we moved to Toronto out of high school, and we sort of had this plan of a 5-year plan of we're going to go to school, we'll graduate, and then we'll give it another few years. And if the band doesn't really make it, we'll just kind of call it a day. And within 1 year of being in Toronto, we found a manager, we got a label, we signed 2 record deals, 2 big labels, and we had a tour booked for the following fall to tour with Hot Chip through North America. And so we deferred school, and that was it. I did 1 year of school, and then it was like, now I'm a professional musician. And at the time, it felt sort of wild, but at the same time, it was just like, well, this is what you do. Like, when it just sort of happens, it feels appropriate or something. Like, you don't take it for granted, but at the same time, you're like, well, this is how it is now, and this is how it will always be. So I guess it was really early on. Like, it was before our first EP. But then, you know, it comes and goes, like, ebbs and flows financially. We had, like I said, we never had that level of success that it was like, we're all going to go buy mansions and live off our royalties. It was always like, yeah, we can pay our rent, but then it's like, when's, you know, what's the next one going to do? And it was always that feeling too, like financially a little bit. Luckily, in your early 20s, you don't have kids and too many responsibilities to pay for. So it was a great age to be paying your rent with music. And it feels amazing. You feel like if you can do that, it's like, you know, you've made it basically. And then the older you get, the more you're like, more money would be good. But yeah, it was early. It was early. And I like to say we appreciated it. But yeah, it all went by in a bit of a blur too, those years. So it's hard to say.
So that's one thing that I kind of sense on this album, on the lyrical front, is a sense of movement forward in life, in thought, in personality, and so forth. Is that kind of where you were at as a person? Was like, life is changing. Whether I like it or not, it's inevitable.
I think so, yeah. A lot happened through the writing. And the biggest change being my wife and I had a kid. And so that impending child, the 9 months leading up to that, there was a lot. That was like a main chunk of the writing was my wife's pregnancy. And then we took a bit of a break. We were recording a lot, actually, too, through that summer. And then he was born in September of 2023. We took a bit of a break from the record. But leading up to that change would have really impacted my perspective and writing. And because it's the ultimate, for me, it's the ultimate perspective change, having a kid. Like, nothing comes close. And from what I've read, for many people. And it really changes everything immediately. Leading up to it, it was a bit of an unknown. There was always the feeling of abstraction of the pregnancy felt real. I knew that this kid was coming, but it felt sort of like, yeah, I'm excited, but it all felt really hard to picture until he was here. And that immediate change in perspective when he was born was so immediate and so amazing and so profound. It just changed everything. I mean, you just fall in love with this thing, and like love does, it takes over everything. And I think leading into that, yeah, the writing, it changed. That was informing a lot of my writing. And even songs that I wasn't necessarily aware of writing about that sort of became about that in a way, where you go, oh yeah, I think that I was writing about becoming a dad. I think that's what that was about. I think Supersonic Man is a good example of initially thinking, yeah, this is sort of like a, I don't know, like it has a vibe and it's like a bit sci-fi. I picture this guy in space, but then I was like flying through space. But then I was like, I think this is actually about somebody being born, emerging into the world, coming to Earth that way. Yeah. Everything kind of became about that in some way.
Yeah, it's a seismic shift because it shifts the relationship that you have with yourself. Obviously, you and your wife, that dynamic changes because now there's three of you, you know? And I'd have to think too, it's like you know, at some point your child will you'll begin to see things about yourself through the child. Because I mean, kids are, you know, spoiler alert, they can be merciless.
I know. I mean, I don't, he's 18 months old now, so it's all still very, very cute and sweet. I can only imagine the merciless days to come.
That's right. That's a all that's a heady thing to get through. It's exhilarating on one hand, but it's also like I'm sure you had moments of terror.
For sure. Anxiety, etc. It's all so far, it's always been outweighed by, I guess, the happiness and yeah, the beauty of it. And you know, we I it's always it, we our experience we had like relatively I don't want to say easy, but like a smooth birth, all of that. It all felt it just so, yeah, I guess joyous and beautiful and wonderful and yeah. But there was, yeah, for sure. There's always fear, anxiety, everything. But yeah, I think it was surprising for me too. I mean, basically from the moment we found out that Laura was pregnant, that was when I realized that I wanted to become a dad. It's kind of crazy, but leading up to that, it was like, it's not that I wasn't sure. I knew it was like, yeah, let's do it. But you don't really know until you know. And it was immediate though. When I found out, I was like, yeah, like I was stoked and I was sort of surprised. I was like completely unsure of how I was going to process the news when it happened. And so, yeah, I've always just really been looking forward to it and excited. And it's always been a real positive thing for me. And I think that also Beauty's Pride is a really positive record. I think everything kind of went through that lens. Even if I'm talking about death and everything else, it all to me resonates in a very positive way. Yeah. Which hasn't always been the case for my songwriting, but to me, this is a very uplifting kind of, yeah, celebratory record. So
Yeah, right. That's it's always a good thing to have around, that music that elevates. Anymore, the more I listen to music, it's always like that's what I want to experience. I want to experience something that's gonna, you know, help me transcend the moment, you know, or help me savor the moment if the moment's good.
And I think a lot of people feel that way. And I know myself, I don't necessarily go to music to be bummed out, but sometimes it can help. You know, sometimes if you are bummed out, sad music can help. Sometimes music reflects how you feel. But I know for myself, I don't necessarily want to listen to a record that's talking to me about how the climate catastrophe is going to kill us all or something. You know what I mean? Like, I get enough of that everywhere else. So if I find out a record is about that, I'm just sort of like, I'll listen to it later. No thanks. I just think, yeah, I think that, and that is, if that's your calling, if that's where you feel responsibility in music, if you're a songwriter, that's great. I just feel like for me with this record, it was more about, yeah, wanting to, I don't know if I wanted to reassure, but I wanted to, what's the word? Like, it's like affirmations or whatever, that kind of thing. I mean, it's not like an album full of positive affirmations or something like that. I think it was just the way it was coming out. It was just what was happening, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I'll leave on this. You mentioned, you know, not having the, you know, the kind of global stardom thing, you know, And within that, I would imagine each time a new record comes out, there's probably a little bit of a new audience that comes through the door. So this is maybe the first record that some people will hear from you by you for some people. So how does that feel, to know that over time, yeah, maybe we don't have like a summer home in Windsor or something, but
at least people are still listening.
You know? Everybody's dream.
Yeah.
That is part of the amazing thing. And what we hope to maintain is that, like, we love that at every show we play. It's a funny thing to love, but we have people come up after many shows and say, why didn't you play more of this record? Like, that is my favorite one. We'll be like, well, we didn't know. Like, we have fans from every era. People who came in for the first record, people who came in for Birthmarks, people who came in for Uncle Duke and the Chief. And it's kind of great. Like, we don't have that feeling of, well, we have to play. There's a couple songs that we know we should put in the set. But even those, sometimes we'll play a song off Red, Yellow, and Blue that we'll think is, well, this is the one. People are going to go nuts. And we play it, and it's a bit of a fart in the wind. Like, we kind of look out, and people are kind of like, it's, and that's great. I kind of like that. We'd never, we have people from each record who came on board for that record, and maybe they went back a bit, but really it was all about that record for them. And I love that. And so I really hope that happens again, because like I said, each record feels like another attempt at being like, this is the thing. This is our thing. This is our masterpiece or whatever. Like, I always feel like that in a way. You never want to make a record that feels like, here's another one. It's maybe our fifth best record, but like, so we want people to really come on board with each record, and we hope that's the case. And I guess time will tell, but yeah, I mean, if you're listening and you're thinking of checking us out, yeah, go check out the newest record, because that is where we're at right now. But I also should say quickly, I feel more comfortable now than ever with our old material. I think there was a time where I rejected I was like, I hate our old stuff. I don't want to play it. Now it's like, I get it. I like all of our stuff. We want to play it all at our shows. We can't. We want to represent each era. We do want our people coming to the shows to leave happy. We don't want to Neil Young them or Van Morrison them and only play the new record necessarily. We welcome all Born Ruffians fans and not Born Ruffians fans. Wisdom and age have given me that perspective for sure.
You've been listening to a conversation with Luke Lalonde of Born Ruffians. The band's new album, Beauty's Pride, is out June 6th via Yep Rock in the United States. You can learn more about the band at bornruffians.ca. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.